And thank you so much for joining us today right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And we love having you with us right here on Progressive Radio Network. That's PRN.FM, because you can listen to The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z every Tuesday, 10 to 11 a.m., if you'd like to be on board with us live. But in addition, if there's something that you enjoy listening to during the show, you'd like to catch it again or tell your friends, a wonderful feature here at Progressive Radio Network is that all of the shows, not only The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, but all of the wonderful shows are archived. So you can listen to them day or night, anywhere in the country, anywhere in the world. And you can always catch us at The Natural Nurse. Today we have as our guest renowned author Kat James. She is an award-winning author, transformational nutrition and beauty pioneer, and a syndicated radio host who's been called a master of self-transformation by Self Magazine in response to her stunning recovery from liver, autoimmune, and eating disorders that nearly took her life. Her controversial and pioneering dietary method, now recommended at top neurologic, fertility, functional medicine, bariatric, and metabolic clinics, has left countless dramatic success stories in its wake and has been featured at top spas and institutions such as Omega Institute, and has been discussed on Today, Fox, and PBS, among others, and today right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. In addition, we're going to be reminding you that Kat James will be presenting at the Naval Expo, and you can find out more at navalexpo.com. We'll be talking about that during our show today. So thank you so much for being our guest right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
Glad to be back here, Ellen. Thank you.
Yeah, you're right. We have done a show before.
Yeah, I think last year, maybe. I hope you've had a great summer. It's great to be back.
So far, it's been fantastic. And I know you wrote a Silver Nautilus award-winning bestseller, The Truth About Beauty.
Yeah. Yeah, it's. I think it was a book that first came out in 2002, but it seems to have a timeless message, because I'm sure you've noticed we've been through some dietary dark ages in recent decades, and there is so much need. The truth doesn't really change, and I find that with some of the headlines that are, I think, a little disturbing, which are kind of one of the reasons I'm excited to be on the show with you today, is to be able to talk about a little-known perspective to all of these headlines, really kind of saying that trying to get healthy, and specifically lose weight, is in vain, and that maybe surgery and lifelong drugs for weight loss are the answer. And those headlines, in particular for the Biggest Loser study, you know, where all of them gained back their weight from season 8, and they cryptically mentioned hormone leptin.
Wait a minute. I want to introduce that topic. Now, first of all, I want to say that, you know, I do know some of the questions you wanted to focus on, which is a great place to start, is The Biggest Loser. So I just want to tell you that I have no idea what The Biggest Loser even is.
Good for you.
So perhaps there are other listeners who don't know. So let's just give a little background on what is The Biggest Loser, and what was that
message? It's a reality show that I made it a point to not watch, because it was based on what I call the huffing and puffing and boot camp mentality of weight loss, and everyone was put on basically low-fat or fat-free diets and driven with everything except for a whip to work out all day long, and some of them lost up to almost 200 pounds and gained it back, and one of them unfortunately lost their life recently. But the study was the Biggest Loser study, believe it or not, that they, over 6 years, followed these people who had lost all this weight and won competitions over that season 8. And those people gained the weight back, but mysteriously ruined their metabolisms. And they started to cryptically mention that their leptin levels were low, and very few people know what leptin is. So I just kind of want to give my take from a scientific standpoint and also a personal
standpoint.
Hold on, that
was really informative. Thank you. So this was a reality show, and it showed people who were probably grossly overweight going through this protocol where they really limited their diet in very unhealthy ways, as a matter of fact, with a low-fat diet. And they promoted excessive workouts for people who weren't used to working out.
Yeah.
And so, of course, that did bring most of their weight down in a short term.
Yep.
But in the long term, it did not lead to better health. And, in fact, most of them regained the weight because they're not approaching it in an intelligent manner. But now it's very interesting to me. You're saying that they actually measured leptin levels.
Yes. Isn't that amazing? Yeah.
Let's talk about what is leptin.
Okay.
And we're surprised that, in fact, it did get measured. It would be a good idea if we measured that in more people.
I agree, although, unfortunately, from the way that that fact is presented in these headline stories, including NPR, New York Times, you name it, this was a few months ago, you wonder if it's just setting us up for a leptin drug, and I'll tell you why I am thinking that. But it is amazing that they measured and they followed these people. And I have to say, you know, the entertainment value of watching people suffer and be humiliated and admonished may be greater than the entertainment value of learning the right thing and just having success without any drama. So this is what happened, and then what ensued was this issue where they're now adding commentary to all of these stories, which really, I think, tells the tale. So, yes, they have this measurement of leptin, and they cryptically choose just to say, their leptin levels were low. And leptin is a hormone that is arguably even more important than insulin. In fact, it's anyone who knows about it knows that it's far more important. It controls and they've even found that it directly affects the microbiome balance. It controls hormone balance. It controls your energy intake. It controls when you're hungry, if it's functioning, when you're full. It is one of the controllers of the hypothalamus completely, and also it grows your cerebral cortex when it's functioning, and that's our self-control center. It balances the dopamine pathways and heals them, and that is something that indicates whether you'll be more addicted or more motivated. And that's really not an overstatement. It also balances the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous systems, so you are able to sleep again, digest again, not be anxious. And what causes leptin levels to go out of whack? The same things that cause insulin or the lack of sensitivity to insulin will do the same with leptin. So about the same time that you're putting on weight, which is a sign of insulin resistance, you are going to be losing your sensitivity to the hormone leptin, and that's what matters, sensitivity to it, not the levels. And so when I read these stories and I see, their leptin levels were low, and then I see a commentary from someone from a drug company saying that they're developing leptin drugs, which they've been trying to do since 1994, not doing well at it because, like insulin, when you give insulin, people will lose their sensitivity to it. So it's, of course, optimally to change your sensitivity to insulin and leptin through diet.
Absolutely. And I just want to say that this leptin is not really new, but probably many people have not heard about it. I do have a complete and total discussion about leptin in my book called Weight Loss, The Alternative Medicine Definitive Guide, and how to change your range and how you should get it tested and watch, because it really can be changed in a positive direction through what you're talking about today, Kat, making the right lifestyle choices.
Yeah, exactly. And that seems to be the elephant in the room. I have to comment that they also added repeatedly in all of these articles, which kind of made my agenda sensor go off, that the gastric surgery worked better in terms of leaving these people's metabolic and leptin intact. and also
I want to share. I want to share a personal story about that at this juncture, because I have always been into health and wellness, and you know, raised my children that way. But you know, I have one child who totally is involved in this professionally. His name is Titus Comet Kohutek, and then my other daughter really chose a different path. You know, we don't own our children. So she, at some point, was very overweight, and she opted against my better judgment and recommendation, but she was a woman already, they're in their 40s, to go with bariatric surgery, and I think she really was, you know, like it's going to be magic, and just I won't be able to overeat anymore, and I have to say, she did lose a lot of weight, but now she has become so nutritionally deficient.
Yes.
That she actually has to get iron IVs. All her blood levels are out of whack.
Yeah.
And I think, again, that it was really the wrong decision. Because what she had to do, and what everyone has to do who chooses that option, which they don't really emphasize, is you have to change your diet and lifestyle after the surgery.
Yeah. Yes.
You could just do that without the surgery and wind up in much better shape.
Yes, and for some people who have that done because of a very skewed relationship with food, it doesn't change the failings of the reward systems in the brain, which can be fixed, again, with diet and some supplements. It doesn't fix that, and there also remains that imbalance in the neurotransmitter function, for example, and other things that would lead them, you know, the thyroid or the adrenals. It doesn't affect any of the issues that you and I both know are behind a trend toward putting on weight, for example.
It's a struggle. You know, I have to say, I really feel for people. I haven't ever had that struggle, because I guess for me, food is, I don't necessarily think about it. I'm not that interested in it.
Right.
I eat a little bit of food because my body needs it, so I'm not a foodie.
Yeah.
But some people wake up in the morning thinking about what they're going to have for dinner that night.
Yeah, I want to give a little insight, because, of course, I came from the other spectrum. And for 17 years have been working with people from all of those spectrums, including, like you, those who have had a pretty healthy relationship with food. And heredity plays a part in that. Past exposures, what your mother fed you plays a part. And also interventions and antibiotics can create the beginnings of a crazy relationship with food. It's amazing how many healthy, as far as relationship with food, people, once they have antibiotics, start to begin this whole world of cravings. But then there is the those with addictive tendencies, and again, these can be, you know, genetic expression even of inherited addiction, which even eating disorders and food addiction are really the same mechanism. Those can be mitigated by, again, nutrition. They found that it's all, as you know, it's all about genetic expression and not our genes as much as we thought, epigenetics and genetic expression. So we can get to where we don't have that issue with food, but I will tell you firsthand, with my 12 years of what is, was truly a heroin-like addiction to food, that this hormone leptin that we've been talking about has the greatest impact, as I've seen with many people with major addictions, to stop it cold. And it is amazing when the body and the brain stop interacting with food as a drug.
So that is wonderful that you're bringing this information loudly and clearly, and you have such an excellent way of sharing information, because leptin might be new information for many of our listeners.
Yeah.
Now, they actually measured it in the Biggest Loser study, and what did they find?
You know, all they commented on, and I didn't look at that extent to it, but is that it was low or non-existent or nearly non-existent in any of them. And really, then they rushed to this conclusion that it was no use, that it's futile, and that your body will always go back to a set point weight. And that is a dubious statement. I'm sure you kind of see an interestingly strange logic in that. But they're basically throwing up their hands, and the copy in all of these headlines, again, or stories, is just saying it's no use and it's not your fault. Let's get wise and do surgery, which worked better, and also Let's Do Lifelong Drugs and the mention of the leptin drug. And so that's where they leave it. There is no discussion about what diet all of these study members did and how they might have done things differently. And I just have to say, you've seen it, and I've seen it in my work. It is more than possible not only to lose weight and keep it off, but with leptin on your side, and it's within all of us. You don't take a pill. You just make it work again for you. And once you make it work again for you, which is literally within days' reach of everyone walking down the street who's not hearing about it, then you will have a different kind of relationship with food, and I'm not exaggerating. Once that signaling starts again, which can happen in as little as 5 days in some people, and even four, all of a sudden there is a hunger or a satiety signal many people haven't felt in their entire life, and that was the case for me. And has been the case for many, many people who've had, you know, 40-year eating disorders, let alone people who don't even have any kind of issue with food. They're very surprised when leptin kicks in because their relationship with food changes, even though they never had what they would see as a bad relationship with food.
And that is, it's sort of an ongoing cycle. Once you make that change, it does get easier because as you discuss with cravings, what's very interesting about those cravings, and you talked about the link to antibiotics, is the fact that antibiotics throw our body into dysbiosis, which involves many things, including the growth of microorganisms that are not friendly to the gut. And those microorganisms actually send out their own hormonal signals that have an affinity to brain tissue receptors, specifically the receptors that tell us we crave sugar.
Yeah.
Why? Because they want sugar.
Yes.
So it's kind of like
literally
little entities taking over our mechanisms and forcing us to eat more sugar. So we have to be strong just for a few days to actually make the intelligent adult decision to not eat it. But, you know, it gets to be less of a struggle as those microorganisms die off.
Yeah. And there is something I call dietary purgatory, and that is when people are still feeding the demon by just thinking it's okay to have a soda here or there or a sweet beverage. It could even be from the health food store. And what affects one person is a little different than the next, of course, and those thresholds at which our blood sugar spikes, for example. Someone who has never had an issue with food can maybe do a banana now and then without harm, whereas someone who has issues like I had, if I did a banana, I'd be thrown into something that I haven't fortunately had to deal with for about 25 years now. So that was about 1990. I didn't know that I had resensitized myself accidentally. It was through an experiment to replicate a feeling of peace that I never felt and tried to replicate because it was so incredible. And I did my own sort of trial and error dietary thing, discovering that the last food in the world that I would have thought would be my ultimate greatest friend, fat, was the one food that did not cause any problems and allowed me to stay in this fleeting, peaceful biochemical state, and finally was able to replicate it 24/7. 10 dress sizes came off, and all of my head-to-toe ailments stopped. And what was in the refrigerator didn't even look like food to me anymore. And I had no idea until 2004, when the foremost expert on the hormone leptin was at a book signing that I was at, what I had done and had started doing and helping other people do, resensitizing to leptin.
It is so fantastic that you give people this kind of information so that they can actually, you know, make an intelligent decision. And it does require a little discipline and self-control. In terms of the cheating, I find, at least with people that I talk to in terms of their nutritional status, that sometimes they do better if we do allow like one cheat day a week. only from a psychological perspective. And sometimes what happens is they begin to notice that difference is so astounding. Like, let's say they stick to it all week, and then they're allowed to go off on Sunday. And then, boy, Monday and Tuesday, they feel terrible.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, we're reminded of what the sugar is doing to us, even though we don't feel it anymore. So many people have so many of these attacks and little mini attacks and recoveries going on in their body all the time. We don't even feel what sugar is doing. With my approach, I don't do weekly, but people sort of discover on their own. But I will say that the more you go, certainly, within one day, you don't want to say, okay, at 3 o'clock, I'm going to do this or whatever, because then you don't allow what is a 3 or 4 day process where you're denying your body's primary fuel, sugar, which it only should be its primary fuel in a famine. You're denying that to the body. The body will go through a little what I call day of reckoning, on the second or third day, where you're not giving your body what it was used to as its primary fuel, and you're giving it the new fuel, which should be its primary fuel other than in a famine, and that is primarily fat. And not to say you're having a plate full of, just a big blob of fat, because, as you know, the appetite drops significantly after about 3 or 4 days, and suddenly it's quite elegant what you're eating, and you're astounded at how your energy completely soars, your sleep deepens, your head clears, and this is on much less food. But the nature of hunger and the nature of the satiety change, and you don't want to interrupt that, because that's what makes everything smell differently, so that you don't even care. You're at the restaurant with your friends, and the bread basket comes, and you're amazed at how it doesn't move you. I mean, with a woman like I was, it's not something that someone who with a healthy relationship with food can even relate to. But when that bread basket comes, it's kind of a moment where you're kind of like not really socially in your head with the people with you. You own that bread basket. And that feeling is gone. And that's pretty great for someone with an eating disorder.
It is so true. So I want to take a little break right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. So please stand by. We will be right back with our fantastic guest. The information she's giving you can be priceless, either to yourself or someone you know who's struggling with really not just weight loss, but let's say with excellent weight maintenance and optimum wellness, because that's where we're going. And we're going to take a little break right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And when we come back, we will continue our discussion with author Kat James. You can always find her excellent information at informedbeauty.com. We'll be right back with more.
On this edition of the Natural Medicine Chest, we'll take a look at the soybean, its phytochemistry, and its role as a food and medicine.
It is exciting to see a resurgence in research by universities and food scientists on the role that foods play in disease prevention. Many of these institutions, such as the United Soybean Board, the American Soybean Farmers Association, and the National Cancer Institute, are busy developing designer foods, or superfoods, concentrating the essential nutrients and phytochemicals in soybeans and other foods that have potent medicinal effects. Commonly known foods which have soy in them include soy milk, a cheese-like substance called tofu, tempeh, a fermented soy protein, and tamari, a fermented soy sauce. The soybean is a rich source of many nutrients, including selenium, zinc, beta-carotene, vitamins A, C, and E, and 20 of the 22 amino acids. Soy also contains essential fatty acids.
Research on soy foods is vast and well known to health enthusiasts, although the general public and physicians in the United States may not be aware of this plethora of research. In Japan and China, however, this is not the case, as a voluminous number of scientific studies have been carried out in animals and humans. Chinese studies reveal that soy products can increase the ability, rate of activity, and number of white blood cells. Patients receiving chemotherapy and radiation can benefit from drinking soy milk, which in several studies demonstrated a protective effect on the liver and gastrointestinal system.
It is interesting to note that the British journal Lancet revealed that vegetarians and Asians who ingest high amounts of soy have the lowest rates of cancer. This is due to one of soy's constituents called genistein. This chemical is a phytoestrogen or plant estrogen, which can decrease and block the uptake of human estrogen and testosterone, as well as enhance its excretion. Like the drug tamoxifen, it competes with estrogen for uptake in the reproductive tissues. By doing so, hormone-dependent cancers like ovarian, breast, and prostate cancers may be prevented.
In conditions where there is a deficiency of hormones, such as osteoporosis and menopause, soy isoflavones, such as genistein, can weakly mimic estrogen and reduce the severity of these problems.
So, listeners, don't count out the versatile soybean. Make it a delicious and nutritious part of your natural medicine chest.
Remind you that you can join us online or on ground. We have so many classes and workshops. If you go to naturalnurse.com and click calendar, you'll see many of the events that are scheduled. For instance, coming right up, we do have a class on career in natural health. Are you interested in switching careers or increasing your flow in terms of your career in natural health, where you're thinking about looking into how you or your loved one or your child could perhaps go into natural medicine the best possible way? Well, we're having an online class about that in just a few days. You can check that out. We also have an herbal certification class that you can take online. And on ground, we have great events coming up, including Chinatown. Dr. Zamperone and I do a Chinatown excursion twice a year. This is our 28th year doing it, so well over 50. So we have some very good experience out there. And so you can join us. We're having our last one of the 2016 season coming right up. And we also have a day in the field where we gather edible and medicinal wild plants, such as weeds, and actually make them into medicine. And you go home with your own salve, your own smudge stick, your own cough syrup that you make out of wild plants that grow right outside your door. And that's coming up as well. Plus, we have the Naval Expo. The Naval Expo, where I do a presentation, and our guest today, Kat James, does a presentation, along with, I would say, over 50 presenters, and this goes on twice a year in the New York area and in the Long Island area. Go to Naval Expo, that's NavelExpo.com, to find out all the exciting information that you can find there. It's a fantastic day. Thousands of people attend, and you are invited. I would say the only bad thing about the Naval Expo is every single hour, there's about five or six different high-level speakers in natural medicine, and you kind of have to decide, although truthfully you don't, because you can go hopping around and do 15 minutes or whatever in each person's lecture and grab the flyers there for more information. Some people like it that way, and other people make a decision and go and do a full hour lecture or spend time and get free samples in the exhibit room. So that's a great thing to find out about NavelExpo.com. So we're going to go back to our guest, Kat James. She is the author of The Truth About Beauty. And beyond that, she has excellent programs, total transformation programs, and teleprograms where she can work with you at a distance, as well as having a radio show on XM Sirius, So she is a fantastic information source for you. So thank you so much for being our guest today, Kat.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ellen.
Now, you're giving us so much information about leptin and your program. Why don't we talk about some of the things that you recommend, which really you have seen excellent results at putting people back on the wellness path?
Okay. Well, in my book, The Truth About Beauty, I talk about a process of shedding. And before we start and buy a bunch of new things, we have to stop the most harmful things. And so I kind of take people not only through a physical process and you know, cutting out sweet beverages, for example, which would completely make you unable to have any of the biochemical changes we've been talking about, and really evaluating with the prescription drugs you're on, which, you know, what brought you there, and diet. When you pay attention in the way we've been talking about, we know it's very easy in most cases to have avoided needing those in the first place, but there are also mindsets, fat phobia, for example. I talk about shedding the mindsets that keep us stuck. The, you know, no pain, no gain is the really the reality show mindset we've been talking about. And the good news is that it is not necessary. If you're doing the right thing, the smart thing based on research, then the struggle should not be needed. And so if people change the mindset and get out of fat phobia, get out of cholesterol phobia, then we can begin to pry ourselves out of this dietary dark age that has led to diabetes statistics as they are, and the obesity epidemic, and the psych drug era. It is my belief that low-fat foods caused them all. And as I, you know, kind of had this self-experimentation where it was so amazing to me that fat was sort of my freedom food that wouldn't cause problems and that kept me in this incredible new place where I would not even think about food as a former food addict, not even think about food until 2 o'clock and, you know, have a regular breakfast, not have horrible energy from it, not have thoughts of food that distracted me from the work I was doing at 11 a.m. And then 2 o'clock would come, and I'm like, I think I'm hungry. And that is what, you know, maybe you, that those who are relatively healthy or who have healthy heredity, et cetera, that's what, quote-unquote, the normal people are supposed, and that's how humans were supposed to be working, with sensitivity to this hormone leptin. And so, you know, I find that starting there, getting people out of the mindset of being afraid of fat is critical to moving forward, and then stopping with, you know, just at least learning to think twice before taking every bit of medical advice to intervene or start a drug therapy. These are things that I start people off with.
Well, you know, that is frightening, as you said, because the pharmaceutical industry really is the most influential and really is tied in with every kind of big business. I mean, I saw horrendous ad that just started, I think, recently about getting the Gardasil vaccine. Mm-hmm. And it's a masterfully done commercial.
Yeah.
Masterfully done. Did you see that one?
No, I haven't, but I don't think I could stomach it. Yeah.
It's horrible, where they have a young girl who winds up getting cancer and a young boy who winds up getting cancer in the commercial speaking to their parents, saying, "You could have stopped this. Gave me the vaccine when I was 12.
The fear factor thing, it's just so wrong. Yeah.
And so talking about, you know, how great it is to do surgery or take a drug that will increase leptin, that's exactly where they're going with this. We know that.
Yeah.
So doing the kind of work you do, which is really educate people about what is actually the truth, the verifiable truth, which seems to be purposefully blocked.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. And so I find that if people start then going to upgrades and looking at the things that are causing the most harm in their life, you know, that sweet beverage, or and how to upgrade, because I think you know as well as I do that if people just get smart about how they make things, you know, using, for example, an alternative sweetener, I call them smart sweeteners in my book, they don't have to do without sweets. They don't have to do without crunchy things.
Okay, wait a minute. Yeah. Let's share. What would be some of those that people would find out in terms of other sweeteners that may not be as harmful?
Sure. You know, I'm sure you're a fan, as I am, of stevia, which has been used for centuries and, in fact, even lowers blood sugar. Some people do okay and others not as well with things like erythritol or xylitol, which I find over 17 years of conducting my programs, maybe 1 out of 12 people is sensitive to it. But we actually make it in the body, so it's not unfamiliar to our body, but it remineralizes tooth enamel, and it's sugar. It's just a 5-carbon sugar instead of a damaging, digestible, and horrible 6-carbon sugar known as sucrose. And it just, it completely changes the outcome of the aftermath, the metabolic, you know, the insulin insensitivity and leptin insensitivity that arises. And people need to know that you're going to also have a difference in your taste buds, and you'll adjust all that. A cherry tomato will soon taste like a piece of candy, and you'll be very, all of a sudden, you'll say, wow, I went half of my life thinking that Brussels sprouts were horrible. Why do they taste good to me all of a sudden? And it's because your entire taste bud reaction completely changes when you get the sugar out of your life. There's a reason that there's only bananas and oranges in the store for Americans, and that is because our taste buds are ruined. The other countries have all of these kind of little, you know, sour berries, much of them which are touted as superfoods in the United States, just growing on trees that people ate because they still had taste buds.
Now, I know you talk a lot about diets that people hear about that, you know, you say really are not the way to go, such as low calorie, low fat. You talked about that a little, and yeah, even things like raw.
Well, actually, I've never spoken out against raw at all. What I want to say is that if people think that it's the only principle, you need to layer the principle of becoming leptin sensitive, which is going to trump everything in terms of its effect. I have a largely raw program, frankly, but people don't see it as that. They don't experience it that way. But raw is great. It's just that if you are, you know, postmenopausal and have already got insulin resistance, or you have a bad relationship with food, or poor energy, or you wake up groggy, or you need a nap in the afternoon, you're going to need to go, you're going to need to layer, everyone should layer, the leptin sensitivity piece back onto the raw. So there's nothing wrong with raw. It's just not the end-all, and people need to think very much twice about juicing if they are a metabolically challenged person, because there are a lot of sources of sugar, even in raw.
Yes, and even in anything. Yeah. Now, would you say the diet that you recommend is closer to what is currently touted as a paleo diet?
Well, that's an interesting question, because I would say no. It's very different. And when anyone goes from paleo to this, they have effects, and their blood work comes back very differently. Because when people cut out sugar and realize that they need protein, they tend to go toward lately a paleo approach. The problem is that excess protein also turns to sugar, and very rarely do you get leptin sensitivity following a paleo approach. However, if you are a type who was never metabolically challenged, instinctively, you go closer to what would work. But those who are metabolically challenged tend to then lean on protein for what they were once leaning on sugar for. A blood sugar spike, and this keeps them from being leptin sensitive, but also excess protein, it causes cancer.
So you're saying eating too much protein?
Yep. Eating too much protein contributes
to it. Now, your diets are not necessarily vegan or vegetarian.
Pardon me?
I said the diets that you're recommending in your books are not necessarily vegan or vegetarian.
Well, you know, no, they're not. And I can't even, you know, these principles can help vegans. But there are some limitations in fat-soluble vitamins, for example, A, D, and E, and the forms of them, and long-chain fatty acids as opposed to short-chain fatty acids that keep
well,
on...
Well, let's go into that a little bit more, yeah. Because that's really, really important information, because a lot of the vegans who come in to see me, when I evaluate their symptoms... really, they are deficient in many, many nutrients.
Yep.
So if they are vegan because that is their spiritual focus, something like, let's say, a kosher person, you know, this is it for me. We're not changing that parameter because that's a spiritual and emotional focus, but it's really not best for health.
Not at all.
Then we have to modify things.
Yeah, not at all. And, you know, there's a woman, Lierre Keith, who wrote an incredible book. She was an 18-year vegan who almost died, and she really searched her soul on the ethical issue. The environmental issue can be very argued with, but it's true. You will be depleted unless you actually supplement, and the supplements come from animals. So that's a real predicament for the vegan. I was vegetarian for 7 years. And my body actually demanded, when I became leptin sensitive, I was really compelled to bring meat back in, and I am, you know, astounded as to how much better I felt. And I didn't need it that often, and everyone has different needs for it. But I don't find that I've ever been able to find, give, you know, help someone achieve optimal health as a vegan.
Yeah, I have to totally agree with you. You can, but you have to do a lot more in terms of supplementation.
Yep.
I think if we're looking at a whole foods diet like your approach, which really works basically for everyone, then including some amount of animal products may be very important.
And can I add, Ellen, that there's only about 1/60th of the conversion rate with oil from flaxseed or borage oil or other vegetarian-sourced omega-6 oils, and I'm sure you know this, but the fish oil is about 60 times as utilized. And we don't make the conversion. It also is affected by heredity, whether we can convert.
Wait a second, Kat. Yes, the fact that I understand that, yeah, that's fine, but you're doing a great job at telling our listeners. So just say what you mean by conversion factor.
Yeah. I can't get, you know, I can't get as technical as I would like to because of my scope of knowledge, but some of the people who know the most about how these conversions happen have, and the studies have shown that flax oil and other sources of alpha-linoleic acid are not as absorbed or converted in many people, and usually about 1/60th the potency and the utilization of the fatty acids as they would be if they consumed the long-chain fatty acids from fish oil.
Right, so there's different chemical changes that can go on with the different oils.
Yeah.
You know, that's the bottom line. And the fact of change actually makes them be able to be absorbed by the cell membranes and be utilized by the body, not just flow through the blood and go back out.
Yeah.
So what you're saying is very true. They actually have different chemical structures, and depending on which kind of fat is available to your cells, they will make different kinds of membranes.
And exactly, and DHA, for example, is a unique fat that has a certain kind of flexibility, which is why your brain cell membranes, in order to transmit signals from cell to cell, if you don't have a generous amount of DHA, then there's a secondary fat that makes up that cell membrane, and your cognition is not as good.
Yeah, there are some unbelievably fascinating studies in terms of the ingestion of DHA in mothers.
Yes.
And intelligence ratios in children measured after 5 years old.
Yep. And ADHD and all of that, exactly.
That's amazing. I mean, to me, that should be shouted from the rooftops, because what an easy, simple, and inexpensive thing for prospective mothers to change their diets.
Yeah, and avoid postpartum depression as well, sure.
That's true. true. It's all good.
Yeah.
So thank you so much for sharing that. We're going to go to one more break right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. You're going to get to hear promos about other shows that are available to you on Gary Mills Network, Progressive Radio Network. And when we come back, we are going to continue our discussion with award-winning author and radio host Kat James, who will also be a presenter. Be very lucky to see her in person at the Naval Expo, NavelExpo.com. We'll be right back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
You're listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Hi, I'm David Crow, host of The Infectious Myth, Tuesdays at 2 p.m. Eastern Time here on PRN.fm. I love science the way it should be practiced, but a lot of modern science is corrupted by financial interests and serves a master other than the public good. Myths continue to be constructed around viruses, vaccines, forensics, and pharmaceutical drugs. People are dying and ending up in jail because of them. Listen to me as I deconstruct the myths that those who call themselves scientists weave, or when I wander into social and political topics. If you're new to the show, check out our past episodes at infectiousmyth.podbean.com.
Hi, everyone. My name is Dr. Michael Wald, and I'm proud to announce that I'm the host of a new show right here on PRN every Saturday at 1 o'clock entitled Ask the Blood Detective. And as your friendly neighborhood blood detective, I'll be exploring all the cutting-edge, important health topics, which will include everything from foods to technology to supplementation and how it impacts your current health so that you can either reach health, maintain good health, or shoot for optimal health and longevity. But what is different about this show is that I'll be describing and teaching you how to interpret your own laboratory tests to find hidden nutritional and health meaning when many other healthcare providers fail to do so. So tune in with me every Saturday at 1 o'clock. Ask the Blood Detective. See you soon.
Thank you for listening to PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
And welcome back to more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. This is Ellen Kamai, PhD, RN, AHG, AHNBC. What does that all mean? Well, AHG means certified by the American Herbalist Guild. And I am also a mentor who takes people through the process so that you could be a certified herbalist. It is really the only nationally recognized certificate in herbal medicine, and it's a really wonderful group, the American Herbalist Guild. And AHNBC is the fact that I am certified as a holistic nurse. So all of you nurses out there can get in touch, and that's another mentoring process that I do so that you can become certified by the American Holistic Nurses Association. And that is really a wonderful organization that is bringing the conversation of holism and natural living back into nursing, where it really was supposed to be all along. Today, we have as our guest Kat James, and she is doing a phenomenal job teaching you why, if you thought that just measuring your cholesterol level and eating really low fat is the way to go, actually puts on the pounds. And it's really almost an opposite approach that brings you into health and balance and puts you in really excellent shape. So thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. You know, Alan, you just commented on the cholesterol thing, and it again points to, it's amazing that people don't realize that, you know, that little small particle LDL that you and I both know is really the only thing to pay attention to, but it doesn't come from diet. It really comes from the liver, and it's a good thing to have your small particle LDL working, but it's the oxidation of it, and primarily from sugar and cheap vegetable oils that actually cause the fissures in the arteries that attract those little things. And people will see, again, if they let go of that fat and cholesterol phobia and really kind of transfer that phobia to sugar, not only just obvious sugars, but things that turn into it rapidly, even juice, even healthy, you know. I did the advanced health food diet, and I still made a drug out of a plate of brown rice, even for me. Whole grains can cause this issue. So if they avoid crossing their own thresholds for spiking their own blood sugar, you'll see your triglycerides go down, and that's going to correspond to a lower amount of those little small particle LDL, which they really should be hearing about from their doctor.
Yes. In fact, if anybody is told they have high cholesterol, yes, the first thing you want to look at, and you can look at your own blood work, is what is the ratio between what's called the HDL, which is considered good cholesterol, we won't go into it too deeply, and the LDL, which is considered bad cholesterol. That stands for low density lipoprotein. That's where it gets interesting. That's what Kat is talking about. And you can go back to your doctor if you have a high LDL. And in most cases, your insurance will pay for what's called an ApoA to ApoB ratio. And that ratio is looking at the low density lipoprotein in terms of just what Kat shared, particle size.
Yeah.
And what you want is not a lot of the little tiny ones, because those stick. And those are the ones that stick to the arteries and other areas in your body and cause the buildup of plaque, which then can also turn into biofilm as microorganisms attach themselves there as well. So that's something you can ask for, every one of our listeners.
Yeah, and it's also very hard to raise your HDL, especially after menopause. And guess what is the thing that raises it the most? Saturated fat from good sources. It's astounding, but that will raise your HDL more predictably and dramatically than just about anything, even exercise.
Now, what would you say some good choices are? And I'm sure you have this in your transformational programs and books.
Sure. You know, good sources of fat and with no phobia of saturated fat. So grass-fed, pastured animal fats, which have a closer fatty acid profile to fish in some ways with their omega-3s. And if you're getting industrially raised animal products, you're getting inflammatory omega-6 fats that are not good. Some omega-6s are okay, but not these. And so it's really the source of the animal. They were always supposed to be eating grass, and if they are properly grazed, you don't even have to, you know, blame environmental issues on them, but you have to support those who are the farmers who are doing the pastured rotational grazing.
It's so true, and we just have to hope, you know, those labelings are accurate. I'll tell you, when you raise your own, you can really taste the difference, because I always raised my own everything on a self-sufficient farm.
Neat.
And when I raised my own animals, slaughtered them myself spiritually, blessed them when they were born, saying they were going to become part of me and my family in a very real sense, literally. And then, you know what? Meat really tasted different.
Mm-hmm.
A liver from an animal raised with love and pastured is actually sweet. Bitter. I mean, it's a whole different energy field. And in terms of meat, you certainly don't need 12-ounce steak.
No, not at all. And there are downsides.
It was always used as a condiment.
Yeah, exactly. And I couldn't agree more. But our overall need to take in food is astoundingly less than we really need to be doing it. And by the end, I do these five-day programs. And by the end of it, I wind up, people are shocked because they're looking at these small amounts like it's really foreign They can't believe on their plate that half of it is sitting there, and yet it was mouthwatering them. That was my experience with myself. It was the first time that I had, you know, the thought that something was mouthwatering happening at the same time as looking at it and being unable to finish the plate.
Wow, so smaller portions also. But you don't need as much when you're eating high-density, nutritious food.
Yeah, and the body is more efficient, so we just don't need as much food as we think at all.
Yeah, very often the Ayurvedic physicians teach that you actually can hold your two palms together.
Yeah.
And whatever size that is, of course we all have different sizes, is plenty of food, they say, you know, for a lot, let's say for the full day. But for Americans, it might be a little challenging, but what I teach is that's good for a meal.
Yeah, that's interesting because that's about right for protein intake, about two palms worth for, unless someone's working out a lot or recovering from injury, and that seems to translate well in terms of protein, certainly.
Absolutely. So let's talk about your programs, because we're actually coming to the end. My goodness,
sure.
This time went so fast.
Sure.
Why don't you tell people about your programs that they can find
sure.
out more about?
Sure. They're called Total Transformation, and I'm actually, Alex at Naval Expo has agreed to sponsor a giveaway, and this is a $3,000 program. I've been conducting these for 17 years. I also do much less expensive online Total Transformation teleprograms. My website's informedbeauty.com. And people might wonder, why is it a beauty? Well, I came from, I was in mainstream beauty. I was one of the top-quoted beauty experts of the 90s and gave that up. I was surrounded by models all those years that I had the eating disorder. And when the, you know, physical change happened, I just decided to call my book The Truth About Beauty, because who was I to get to write a health book? I was just a makeup artist at that time. But, you know, 7 years and 40 pages of medical citations later, I felt I had something that had some validity. And the science really has been pouring in, vindicating what was a really controversial approach when I really came out with it in 2000. And so now we're seeing, you know, 16,000 studies on dietary stuff collected in a meta-analysis, and that turns out to show that it was in the right direction, and that low carb is absolutely the answer, but that high fat, which Sweden and Norway are acknowledging to be superior, is really here for the informed. It's here to stay.
Yes, and you were a forerunner. Where did you find out about it?
That's a great question, Ellen. I had this horrible eating disorder. My liver was starting to fail. My gut was no longer. I was passing undigested. I was dying. And so I went to, before the internet, a bookstore, looked up liver. It started recommending certain supplements. I fixed my liver and had a couple of days where I ate that were opposite in how I ate from the usual whole grain kind of diet. And I tried to replicate it. And over a year and a half, I was able to keep this state of peace going. And it was, I had resensitized myself to leptin 4 years before the hormone was discovered, and it wasn't until 2004 again when I described that people had this appetite drop off after about 3 days, but you had to eat a lot of fat, but there was no more portion control. That was when the presence of Dr. Ron Rosedale, one of the foremost experts on the hormone, was there, and he said, "You have resensitized people to leptin. There's no one else doing this." So that's how I found out, just by trial and error.
And I do want to thank you so much and for your continued research and supporting that you were on the right track and how many thousands of people have been helped by the information you share. So we're going to sign off. I want to invite you to visit navalexpo.com, sign up to come to the next live event. Both myself and Kat James are two of the many, many excellent presenters there. You can find me at naturalnurse.com or Facebook, The Natural Nurse.
Thank you.
Until next time, this is Ellen Kamai, The Natural Nurse, hoping that you stay healthy.